I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Our first guest today is a politician whose core beliefs defy traditional definitions. Bill White is a big city Democrat who served three terms as mayor of Houston before an unsuccessful challenge to Texas Governor Rick Perry in 2010. Bill White describes himself as a social progressive, but when it comes to government finances, he's a hawk. He's worried that America has turned its back on history and mortgaged away its future with deficits. Worse, he says, we've lost the political will to reduce the debt through a combination of difficult spending cuts and higher taxes. A conversation with Bill White about deficits, Democrats, Republicans, and the coming elections on Midday. First, the news from NPR. Good afternoon, one and all, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF out of Frederick and Hagerstown, WYPO the Eastern Shore and Ocean City, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. We thank you again for making Midday part of your day. Our first guest on the show today says that as a nation, the United States behaves like a worker who can't live with his salary, so he borrows to meet expenses. Even if he gets annual pay raises, he can never improve his standard of living because he needs more and more money to pay off his debt service. That's not the kind of talk you expect to hear from a big city politician, but Bill White has never been easy to put in a political pigeonhole. The Democrat served three terms as mayor of Houston, the nation's fourth largest city, and he calls himself a progressive on social issues. But when it comes to spending, he says that in the long term, the government should only spend what it collects. That's a core belief presidents and congressmen of all persuasions have embraced in principle and largely in practice until the 21st century. In fact, that behavior was so ingrained that Bill White calls it America's fiscal constitution, which incidentally is the name of his new book, calling for a return to balanced budgeting. Even when federal budgets have gotten out of whack in times of war or national emergency, he argues, they've always been restored to balance shortly afterwards. And even when Franklin Roosevelt was borrowing for massive federal projects during the Depression, Bill White says, the president wouldn't let his staff claim that public works created those indirect jobs as a result of spending by construction workers. That's because FDR didn't want people to believe the government could create prosperity by spending huge amounts of borrowed money. In fact, the last balanced federal budget occurred, do you know when it occurred? Under a liberal Democrat, Bill Clinton, as the result of a deal with a conservative Republican, Newt Gingrich. Bill White says this general agreement began to unravel permanently in 2001 when George W. Bush decided to fund an expensive war off the budget and pushed for lower taxes at the same time. Bill White doesn't give President Barack Obama much better marks as the country struggles with political gridlock and borrows a third of the dollars it spends every year. How can we fix things? Bill White has some ideas about that, and he'll tell us about them and talk some politics with us this hour of Midday. Bill White was one of the most popular mayors in Houston's history before losing a 2010 battle to unseat Rick Perry, the conservative Republican governor of Texas. As mayor, Bill White won the John F. Kennedy Profiles in Courage Award for his leadership in helping victims of Hurricane Katrina. A lawyer and businessman, Bill White served as Deputy Secretary of Energy in the Clinton administration. Today, he's a senior advisor at Lazard, the prominent international consulting firm. And the book, as I say, is called America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse, available from Public Affairs Press. So, Bill White, welcome to Baltimore, WYPR and the Midday Show.
It's great to be with you, Dan.
So you're a deficit hawk, and when people see you coming, how do they respond? You know, this is very interesting to me that you know, we don't really we talk about deficits and the national debt and all that, but no one seems to want to do much about it.
Yeah, and what's remarkable is how relatively recent that sort of apathy is.
Mm-hmm.
The trends, Dan, are incredible. Just in 2007, the vast majority of Democrats thought that borrowed money and borrowing every year was a big mistake, and they were very worried about it, more so than Republicans. And then there was an election, and then those percentages flipped. But the fact of the matter is that whether you're conservative or progressive, it shouldn't matter. Look, if the government has $100 of revenues to spend, would we be better off spending that on public services or on debt service for something done in the past? I'd say it's better off to spend it on public services and not mortgage a future.
What got you to this subject, Bill?
You know, I think it's, Dan, going to be one of the principal sort of underlying issues in the next 10 or 20 years in American politics. Plus, there were so many myths. It was fun. You know, all of us have a little bit of fun popping myths. I know you have in the past. You know, this whole myth that, oh, we never balance a budget. Well, we balanced a budget in 2000, and everybody celebrated that, and nobody woke up the next morning saying that was a terrible mistake. We only borrowed for four extraordinary purposes for about 90% of the nation's history. So this idea that somehow the government has to live beyond its means or it's inevitable just makes no sense. And there's a lot of other myths that I point out, but that's one of them.
Well, we're going to walk through that history because it is really interesting, and you will pop some myths as we go along, Bill. But I just want to ask you about current conditions. What I'm reading from the Congressional Budget Office in 2014 is that the government's deficit is falling. It's down to $492 billion this year. Some people think it's manageable, around $460 billion. They use the term manageable because they look at the deficit as a percentage of the economy, of GDP, at 2.5 to 2.8%, and there are those who argue, economists, including Paul Krugman and others, that that's manageable.
Well, two parts. First, you know, of course, the deficit is going down because we had this immense borrowing when we had two wars plus the worst downturn that occurred since the Great Depression going on at the same time. Our nation has borrowed during wars, although it previously had raised taxes during wars, and it has borrowed since, you know, 1819, when there was a severe economic downturn. But then the national income has returned to an all-time high. Yes, there are people who want to be employed who do not have jobs, but that does not mean that we're in a recession. The national income is at an all-time high. And so there's no reason why we should be continuing to borrow to pay for routine operating expenses. There was a debate about what we should do with the Great Recession, and I think I'm generally on the side of those who say that, you know, both in the last year of the Bush administration, early Obama administration, people used extraordinary measures to deal with an extraordinary circumstance, and it could have been a whole lot worse if you look at economic history. But now we're borrowing to pay for routine medical expenses such as Medicare as the baby boomers are retiring, and that is not sustainable. And just to give you one fact that, you know, for to put that in concrete, that Congressional Budget Office that you cited notes that you know, this year we're spending $425 billion on debt service. That's like, you know, $3,000 per working family in the country. And that number will go up to over $900 billion in debt service, and just interest on prior debts, right after 2020. Well, that's more money than we collected in personal income taxes in 2010. And the issue is, would you rather, you know, why not balance the budget if a public expenditure is worth making, why not pay for it? And similarly, if the public is absolutely unwilling to pay for an expenditure today, why disguise the cost by borrowing from our kids?
So I get you. So your message is to those who say deficit is manageable, you'll say, well, there's no need for it. There might be an extraordinary situation such as a war, such as a recession, where the government needs to spend money because the private sector isn't spending money. But after that, you need to clean up and get to a balanced budget.
Yeah, exactly. And so you'll have your credit left in the future. In other words, if somebody says it's manageable, that's a euphemism for, you know, well, there won't be a crisis. But I'll tell you what, when the federal government goes into credit markets and borrows money, then, you know, virtually all economists agree that that will have a tendency to push up interest rates. The more the government borrows to pay for routine expenses today, then the higher the share of future tax dollars will need to be devoted to debt service. That's a disservice to the people who come after us.
Bill White is our guest in this hour of midday, former mayor of Houston. His book, America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse. It's quite a tome, quite a bit of work here with charts and graphs, appendices. I forget how many pages, Bill, more than 400 pages plus the appendices in the back. But so you wanted to take a look at the history here of how our government has handled budgets over the years, going all the way back to after the Revolutionary War and the start, right, the start of our government. I was curious if we could start with you around 1812, 1814, if you don't mind, since we're broadcasting from Baltimore. 1814, 200 years it'll be since the War of 1812 reached the shores of Baltimore here. And to finance that war, I just wonder, you know, how did we pull that off? How did our government pay for that extraordinary circumstance?
Well, it was set up. What a great, I mean, I love this stuff. So, and you're right. You're right in the heart of history. And I could give you another one where about Mann's Tavern in Baltimore. There's an unbelievable story, but
Well, you can tell any story you like. Mann's Tavern.
Could I start there? Could sure. I start there?
Yeah.
Let me say,
anything
I'm
involving
start
a tavern, I'd like to hear about.
Yeah. Oh well. I mean, you know, I'll check out your reputation. But so, listen, we borrowed money during the War of Independence, and then afterwards, everybody, sort of a lot of people in the colonies, the new independent states, acted like they wanted the creditors to forget about it. But, you know, there were creditors that included the soldiers during the war and foreign banks that people needed to do imports and exports, which are critical to the colonies. George Washington had just about given up in 1786. He wrote to a friend that the Confederation of States had been formed with a overly optimistic view about human nature, because they were doing what is being done now, which is that they were borrowing money every year, in other words, issuing new notes in order to pay the interest and not paying down the principal of the Revolutionary War debts. Well, there was a meeting that was supposed to occur at a place called Mann's Tavern in 1786 in September, where they were supposed to talk about how to adjust the commercial relations between Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, New York, the coastal states, Delaware. And there's a few people who had an idea that there ought to be another meeting called, that this was a serious issue. We needed the national credit. So they sent out a notice to the other state saying we need to deal with the problems of the national credit and make any other, they said, correspondent adjustments in the federal system. They met. They came up with a reorganization plan. A new entity was formed to assume the old debt. It was called the United States of America. That was the story of the Constitutional Convention. It started with this meeting of how to work out debts there at Mann's Tavern. But after we did become a nation, we did adopt the Constitution, people for years worked to pay down that debt every year during Thomas Jefferson's administration, except when he borrowed for the Louisiana Purchase, the debt was paid down. And so that when we did go into the War of 1812, we had credit. If it had not been paid down, we wouldn't. And a test for that is the War of 1812 ended. The peace treaty, as you know, was signed just days before the U.S. government was due to default for the first time on its debt. We had run out of credit, and here's the story, the British had run out of credit just about the same time.
Is that right? Really?
Yeah. That's what happened. I mean, Parliament, they discussed it. They didn't want to spend any more on the war. They didn't have any more money to spend. They got through Napoleonic Wars, and that's why the War of 1812 was basically a wash. That is, both sides agreed that they would basically go back to the way it was before it war of 1812.
That's a good reason to oppose debts, deficits, and debts. And you know, part of your aversion to war, it'll lead those to who want to execute a war to maybe stop it earlier than usual.
Yeah, we would have. I think the course of the last dozen years in American history would have changed if people have taken the same attitude that President Madison did, that the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, I quote, in the War of 1812, when Congress finally did vote to raise taxes, only then did the president say, well, that shows that there must be enough support to go to that war. There were war hawks before then because the British were taking our, the crews on our ships and intercepting our vessels. But the president and most in his party thought if people were unwilling to tax themselves to pay for a war, then maybe you shouldn't get into the war. I imagine if we would have had that attitude about the invasion and occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Bill, we'll take our first break here and come back and talk some more. Bill White, former mayor of Houston, our guest on Midday Today. His book is America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse, taking a walk through history to see how various presidents and members of Congress have handled the nation's budget over the centuries. This is Midday. Dan Roderick's here. If you'd like to give us a call, if you have a question for our guest, 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. And the Midday email address is midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. Our guest this hour, Bill White, won the John F. Kennedy Profiles in Courage Award for his leadership in helping victims of Hurricane Katrina, who flooded Houston from New Orleans, you'll recall. That was during the second of Bill White's three terms as mayor of America's fourth largest city, Houston, Texas. He was reelected with about 90% of the vote. And he got more votes than any Democrat in Texas history when he tried to unseat Republican Governor Rick Perry in 2010, but still lost. Of course, that was before Rick Perry self-destructed during the Republican presidential debates in 2012, but making noise about running for president again. And Bill White, I'm just curious, I'm dying to ask you a couple of Texas political questions during this hour with you. The governor's race in Texas, now I just read the other day, Wendy Davis is the Democratic nominee. Mm-hmm. A lot of us got to know her because of her filibuster in the assembly down there and her sneakers, right?
Right.
But she's running for governor, and I'm hearing she has no chance. The Democratic Party hasn't, the National Party hasn't helped her out very much. What's going on in Texas as far as that goes?
Well, first, Wendy Davis is a great candidate. I've known her. She's very mainstream. The president isn't that popular in Texas. He did tend to lose independents after the 2008 election. I saw it in our polls. But Texas will be back and competitive between the two parties in the near future. It's just a shame that, right now, if it wasn't, I could tell you stories that if it wasn't true, it'd be funny. We had a debate in a Republican primary runoff for lieutenant governor just about a week ago, where the two candidates in the runoff competed by affirming how much by trying to best each other and how much they believed in creationism and how strongly they would try to fight for creationism being taught in the public schools. And maybe in 1924, but I'm not sure in 2014.
Yeah, I know what you mean there, Bill. One last question then. We keep hearing that Texas's demographics are changing, and as you said, there will be competitive elections between Republicans and Democrats again someday. Is that what everyone's waiting for the nature of the populace to change down there?
Yeah, and I do think there is a, we're a mainstream we have a mainstream Democratic Party, and we have a number of people who vote Democratic on the local level and then vote for folks on the national level, they will cross party lines at times. And I think the issue that we're talking about in the book is a very serious one for Democrats and all progressives, really, to think about. There's no reason why some of the people in the GOP should be considered stalwarts for fiscal discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Fiscal discipline broke down in 2001, but it's not enough to complain about the other people. Right now, what we're seeing in those Congressional Budget Office numbers you talked about earlier, Dan, is that everything, education, scientific research, virtually all domestic spending is going to be squeezed out by debt service and medical expenses in the next 10, 15 years. That isn't some kind of right-wing prediction. That's in the forecast within the White House budget. And I don't think that's right. I think that we need more balance in the budget.
Let's go back to the history, Bill. Let's see. I'd like to go slip up to the Civil War now, maybe 30 years after the period that we were talking about where the debts from the Revolutionary War were finally paid off around 1835.
Right.
We get to Abraham Lincoln. President Lincoln certainly ran up a lot of bills for the Civil War. Now, did that leave the country with a large debt, and how long did that take to pay off?
Oh, a vast debt. Mm-hmm. It was there was a lot of talk about how, you know, could this ever be paid off, but, you know, a lot of people forget, and the 14th Amendment, which along the two great post-Civil War Civil Rights Amendments, 14th, 15th Amendment, along with 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery, and the 14th Amendment, it said right there that the United States would honor its debt, and there was a reason for that. And the reason for it is that there had been so many people who had sacrificed their lives in order to preserve the Union that they wanted to finish the job by paying down the economic debt and the economic bleeding that was still going on after the final surrender of Lee's army. And so, you know, Democrats and Republicans after the Civil War, people talk about partisanship today. My goodness, Dan, you wouldn't believe, I mean, there would be, I guess you'd call moderate, you know, Republicans that would call the Democrats the rebel party who caused the war, and Democrats who believed that Lincoln's blundering caused the loss of life of hundreds of thousands, millions, really over a million Americans. So this was very personal. Yet Democrats and Republicans agreed on one thing: we needed to pay down that debt. And in the 54 some odd years after the Civil War, we only borrowed for a handful of years. Most of those years we played surpluses and we paid down that Civil War debt.
Now we'll go into the 20th century and the Depression, the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt that I mentioned in the introduction here, because this really is interesting. Of course, FDR tried to jumpstart the economy during the Depression with all those public works projects, a whole array of them financed by debt. But he believed it should only be a temporary tactic, even though a lot of people consider, you know, probably look back on history and think of Roosevelt as a great deficit spender.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, he was at the White House every week and going through all the major, you know, the WPA projects, major construction projects, one by one. And he and Secretary Ickes would be looking, so they didn't want to be accused of doing any boondoggles. They wanted things that had long-term permanent value, because only for those types of things could you justify borrowing and imposing a mortgage on the future. Roosevelt set a record for presidential vetoes in total and presidential vetoes of spending bills. Sometimes he would tell his staff as a reminder to people of the need to retain fiscal discipline and balance the budget once we came back from the Depression. He told his staff to go find bills, spending bills he could veto, simply in order to send that message. That's a little bit different tone than we have today.
So basically you say that presidents and lawmakers of both parties generally did find a way to pay off debt, even if it took a while. That's the example. It's two examples so far. Was that also the case after the New Deal?
Well, that was the intention, and President Roosevelt talked about it, you know, incessantly to the public, reminding them that any debt would need to be repaid as soon as the economy recovered. But as you recall, there's a little something that happened called Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
And then that's when you saw something occur that, you know, I'll tell you, those who, and Japan, Italy, and Germany, they nobody in the earth ever saw anything like the mobilization, industrialization that occurred in the United States in 1941 through 1945 after this nation was attacked. It was unbelievable. And it was financed by a combination of higher taxes and debt. The pace of spending, the percentage of the economy that was devoted to the military is unprecedented. But here's a fact that many people don't realize. By 1945, the last year of the war, and it wasn't like the war was winding down, you know, I mean, we were pressing it. We were talking about a land invasion of Japan, and the armies were fighting their way into Germany. In 1945, the federal taxes covered the same percentage of federal spending as they did in 2010. Now, you know, in 2010, we had a severe economic downturn, no doubt about it. But people raised taxes repeatedly during World War II because they felt that it would be wrong to put the entire cost onto the next generation of Americans and basically have debt service absorb all of the federal budget after the war.
So there's that separation there in thinking and also sort of a physical separation of the in the budget. I wanted to talk about this a little bit because I thought it was important. This goes back to the New Deal and Roosevelt continuing a policy of Hoover. So you had a budget where one part was like the routine spending that you have to do that's based on taxation, tax revenue.
Right.
And then there's this other part in the New Deal, and then leading into World War II, relief recovery programs, WPA, all these public works projects funded by debt and designed to end once recovery comes, right?
Yes.
That's an important distinction made there.
Important distinction. And by the way, they did end. Except for the agricultural programs, which had now become almost a part of American life, the idea that the cyclicality of farm commodity prices had to be moderated if the family farmer was to have any survival. Except for that program, the New Deal spending programs were by and large dismantled during World War II. And then after World War II, for a period of 20 years up until Vietnam, the federal debt barely budged. Now, unlike occurred after World War I, the Civil War, War of 1812, we didn't pay down debt because there was the Cold War. But people realized in 1950 there was a critical turning point in the Cold War where there had been a battle from 1945 to 1950 about whether we should have a global security umbrella paid for by taxation or whether we should not have a global security umbrella. But people never considered paying, you know, borrowing money to pay for routine defense spending.
Mm-hmm.
That was considered a way, basically, it was like financial disarmament if you borrowed money to pay for routine defense spending. And yet, that's what we're doing today.
That's what we're doing today. But just so we understand, we came out of World War II with debt from the war, of course, but also from the New Deal, mm-hmm. and took a long time to retire that because we entered into the Cold War period.
Yeah, and that was very recently, that was the peak of debt if you would measure the burden of debt the way a banker and a financial analyst would measure a debt. If you go to a private sector company with a small, you know, any small business person listening to the program, or any big business for that matter, they go to the bank. I'll tell you what the bank looks at. They look at something called a debt coverage ratio. Now, that's a fancy term, debt coverage ratio. What does that mean? This is one of the basic standards for determining credit worthiness that's used every day in the United States. It means they look at the income coming in,
mm-hmm.
and they compare that income to the amount of outstanding debt. And believe me, anybody who's applied for a mortgage knows what we're talking about.
Yeah.
They look at your income, and then they look at the relative amount of the mortgage that you're applying for. Well, today, their debt is 9 times the amount of total revenues available to pay for debt that's coming into the U.S. government. That has not occurred over an extended period of time at any time in this nation's history since before the administration of Thomas Jefferson. And if you just want to be thinking about this, some of these numbers, when we talk about trillions, you know, it's hard to visualize, but just ask yourself this question. How would you feel if you had a home mortgage that was 9 times your annual income? I'd feel pretty uncomfortable.
Me too. I mean, the rule of thumb used to be, what was the basic rule of thumb back when we were going to go out and buy a house? Your monthly mortgage payment should be no more than 1/4 your gross.
Yeah, or 2 or 3 times your income, or you could take, but yeah, you're in the range here.
Right.
And there's a basic logic for that if people think through it, which is that if you allow your debt to be so much greater than your income, like 9 times, 10 times your annual income, then all of your income or most of your income will be used for paying interest on the debt, and very little would be available for either paying down the debt or paying other expenses, such as your living expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing with the federal government. If you take all the revenues, and now I'm putting aside the ones that can't be legally spent for debt service, our Social Security payments, the contributions that federal employees make to their pension funds, those are trust fund payments. But the what are called federal funds budget, basically corporate income tax, personal income tax, and a number of other sales taxes, excise taxes, and fees, but it's mainly income taxes. An increasing share of those taxes every year are going to be absorbed by debt, leaving less to be used for everything else, forcing people into a situation where they feel they have to borrow to make their interest payments every year.
Okay, but when you're running a household, you can increase revenue. You can go out and find a part-time job. You can tell your 24-year-old son who's living in your house that he has to pay rent. You can increase revenue in order to cover debt and your other expenses. For us to do this here in the United States, in the government, we need to raise taxes to increase revenue, and that's where the politics enters into this. That's why we had tax cuts during the Bush years and 2 very expensive wars.
Yeah, absolutely. And one reason why some economists don't look at the debt service ratio is they say, you know, you can always just raise taxes, so it's not like a family.
No.
You're right, a family can't get an extra job.
It's hard to raise taxes now, especially in this climate.
There's a limit. I mean, there's another thing. There was the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and the president went on TV and said this is going to mean taxes and debt and taxes and a lot of sacrifice by everybody involved. And everybody knew that, so, you know, they knew that things aren't free. We enacted an income tax bill then in 1942, and it went in full effect the next year, called Revenue Acts of 42. Listen, since that time, the personal income tax collected by the federal government has been between about 7 and 9% of the whole national income. And it's usually been right at the middle of that range or a little bit over 8% within a few tenths of a percentage point. This is when Reagan was president, when Eisenhower was president, when Truman was president, when Obama is president. It's fallen within that general range. So don't say that it's all that easy to raise taxes. You can shuffle them around a little bit, but there is a limit. And even during World War II in 1944, when it reached that limit, and President Roosevelt was president for even more, Congress overrode his wishes on a bipartisan basis because people had about enough.
Bill White is our guest in this hour of midday. We're going to take another break here, Bill. We'll come back and talk some more. Former mayor of Houston, former candidate for governor of Texas, now a senior advisor at Lazard. His book is America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse. Welcome back to Midday. Our conversation with Bill White, former mayor of Houston. His book, America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse. Bill, one of our listeners, Mike, calling into the show to ask you a question. Mike, how you doing?
Hey, Mike. Hi, Bill and Dan.
Go right ahead, Mike.
As you said, we were running a surplus under Bill Clinton. And then when Dick Cheney came in and said deficits don't matter and we got the Bush tax cuts, everybody's been paying less ever since. So we, not too long ago, we all paid higher rates. And our financial situation, at least from a deficit debt perspective, was improving. I don't understand. It seems to me that the rhetoric that has kind of been ginned up against the government is that it's not a public good, that it can't be trusted, is kind of intentional. There's incredible wealth at the top. I think there's some folks that want to pay their, that want to contribute there, that they say they can and would pay more. But then there's another group of folks that, you know, want to retain everything that they've amassed. And I'm curious what your thoughts were in terms of how we can kind of change the dynamic so that all of us, including the wealthy, step up and acknowledge that we all have a responsibility as citizens to pay in to support these things that we all need for the citizens, whether it's Medicare or retirement under Social Security or defense or admin. You know, all those things are things that we all recognize make our country a better place. I just feel like the money is there.
They don't all recognize that, Mike. I'm going to let Bill respond to this, but they don't all recognize this. They refer to the nanny state, the welfare state. They don't want to contribute to that. They think our spending, social spending, is gone off the charts, and they were opposed to Obamacare all through this. So I'm not sure. It's a nice idea, Bill. I'll let you respond. It's a nice idea of getting everybody to hold hands and say we're all in this together, but I don't see it.
See, the balanced budget principle used to, you know, let out a lot of the hot air out of the debate because you're forced to link your spending and tax policy. I think the truth is, you know, that both your comment back to Mike and Mike's comment both had merit. Here's the truth. You hear a lot on voices on the right complaining about entitlements, but there's not a single member of Republican member of Congress who is now elected in office who campaigned to end Medicare and Social Security.
Well, Paul Ryan put out a proposal.
Yeah, no, I mean, what his proposal is, his proposal on Social Security is, well, let's keep it the way it is. Let's keep it the way that it is under the Affordable Care Act and under predecessor legislation.
I was talking about Medicare especially.
Yeah, in Medicare until, you know, 8 or 10 years from now, and then let's start making changes. On Social Security, the trust fund, is in good shape compared to the rest of the budget. On Medicare, it's a serious problem. We're borrowing money to pay for Medicare. And in 2001 and 2003, if we had followed traditional policies, it would have put those people to, it would put some conservatives to the test who would say, okay, if we're going to have this tax reduction, then let's cut government spending by that same amount to balance the budget. But they did not want to do that. And the Democrats, instead of saying, like Harry Truman would have said, well, if you're going to cut taxes, let's cut back on the spending, and I'll see you at the polls in the next election. Instead of doing that, they said they claimed to have protected these programs by allowing them to be funded by unsustainable debt.
I'm thinking back to Roosevelt again. He didn't want to create the impression that the government could create prosperity by spending large amounts of borrowed money. When we look at the defense spending in the United States, Democrats, Republicans, you know, there's a lot of talk about cutting defense spending, but we don't see it. I mean, we see a slowdown in the growth of spending in the defense budget, but it seems like the argument there is, if you spend on defense, then you create prosperity, you create jobs. That's good spending versus, you know, spending for entitlements.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, you know, that is to say, I understand what you're saying. I think
that's the argument.
That's the argument. But more fundamentally, here's what you have in the paradox you have. Some of the people, including Mr. Ryan, who are most adamant about the virtues of tax cuts are also the most adamant on the need to spend more on the military. He counted as a triumph in January when they raised the ceiling that Congress itself, with the president's signature, had imposed on military spending in 2011. Mm-hmm. That was counted as a victory. Now, I'm all for having a great debate about the importance of the global security umbrella of the United States. I just think that citizens should be asked to pay for it and not have a situation where we temporarily enhance global security and then we force people later on to make hard choices to retrench. And we're around this region that we're in right now, Dan, we're going to be facing the consequences. Here's a gruesome fact, and that is that if you take the amount of money that was borrowed to pay for the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, plus the interest that accumulates each year on that, because we're not, you know, we're borrowing money to pay that interest, plus the veterans benefits, both in the Veterans Bureau and others that we promised the people who served our country so well, by 2020, the annual cost of that will be as much as the peak cost for the wars themselves. So, in effect, we will be financing the equivalent of the 2007 surge levels of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan just with interest payments because we refused to make the sacrifices, civilian sacrifices, to pay for those wars through taxation.
Bill, I'm going to read you an email that comes to us from West Virginia, from a retired lieutenant commander of the U.S. Coast Guard, former helicopter pilot at Air Station Houston, David says. He says, please ask Bill White if he would agree that absent a constitutional amendment requiring a balanced budget, except during the period of a declared war, we will never stop deficit spending because most of our elected representatives only work for re-election, not the best interests of our country.
Well, in the old two issues. First, right now it's clear that incumbents have made commitments on taxation and spending. Incumbents in each party, they've made a commitment on spending, commitment on taxation that don't add up. I mean, even if you, brought the tax increases that applied to the top 1% down to the top 3%, as the president from time to time has suggested, you don't come close to eliminating the deficit. So they both made these promises, and then the Republicans, you know, every year they vote to for a budget in excess of the revenue estimates. So they both incumbents are on a limb. But historically, American people have been very suspicious of this activity. You remember when Mr. Perot came along in 1992 and started speaking about it, and between the time he said that he'd think about running for president, Larry King, 7 weeks later, he was number one in the polls. And he had a lot of quirks and flaws, but people understood that we needed to bring our resources in line with our commitments. So I think that there is some political will. Now, there is this issue of a constitutional amendment. Sometimes I'm a little bit apprehensive that the constitutional amendment would be used as an excuse not to do something now. That occurred during the Reagan administration, where President Reagan was adamantly in favor of a constitutional amendment to balance the budget and always submitted a budget with a large deficit, larger than the one deficit that Congress wound up passing. And so, plus, there is something a little bit original in research in the book. It's hard to define what a severe economic downturn is. You know, you don't put graphs in the Constitution of the United States. And so in recent versions of the balanced budget amendment, like the one that almost passed Congress in 1995, came within one vote in 1995, allow 60% vote, supermajority vote, to authorize borrowing. Well, if you have that situation, you could very well have an instance in which the only way you could get a budget through would be to spend more and tax less in order to round up 60% of the votes, and that wouldn't do you any good at all.
What happened when you were mayor of Houston? You had a city charter that required a balanced budget?
Yeah, I mean, and this is another reason why you know, to the person who just had emailed in, that I do have some confidence. Look, I was a big city mayor, and our city, like the other cities and counties and most states in the United States, do not allow you to borrow for routine operating expenses. By and large, you're allowed to borrow in state and local governments in the United States of America only for capital improvements and only in amounts that have been authorized by bond issues, votes of voters. And somehow our country has done just fine within those limits. I don't see why the federal government couldn't operate within a similar limit.
Tom wrote in to say that he finds the comparison of a household budget to a federal budget, comparing apples to oranges. He says this is a typical GOP conservative talking point. I'm tired of hearing of it, but he doesn't say why it doesn't work. But what about you? Is it too simplistic? We used that. We talked in that in those terms for a few minutes today, Bill. Is it too simplistic?
Well, I mean, there are several differences, and I just urge a listener, read the book. And I know a few things about macroeconomics, and we're not, you know, ignorant of the topic. The federal government can monetize some debt, and it has been doing that. And that debt, I don't include in my ratios because when the Federal Reserve buys the debt and keeps it on its balance sheet and credits the interest back to the Treasury, they're basically, as Bernanke said, characterized it a few years ago, printing money to cover that amount of the debt. The federal government can do that, but I subtract out the monetized debt from the figures that I use in the book in order to account for that. The federal government does have and has historically had some responsibility to try to, at least since the New Deal, to moderate the economic cycle in part by not raising taxes and cutting spending during the depression or recession. I don't advocate that we do that. But how can it be progressive? Ask yourself this. If you're concerned about the consequences in 2040 and 2050 of climate change, like I am, or if you're concerned about the consequences of the future of our country in 2040 or 2050 if we don't start with excellent preschool programs available to all people in our country, if you're concerned about those things, then you ought to be concerned about mortgaging a higher and higher percentage of future tax revenues to pay prior debts.
I think maybe the hero in your book is Dwight Eisenhower among all the presidents. At least for this comment, kind of prescient, really, on many counts, that farewell address that he gave as president included these lines, advising his fellow citizens to, quote, avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage.
Absolutely. And that was in his farewell address that he wrote. You know, he went through 35 drafts that are as best remembered by his, you know, comments about the development of a new military and industrial complex in the United States. But the context that he was placing that in was the continuing costs of having this, Cold War spending. And he was being assaulted, and he got defensive because both Kennedy and Nixon during the 1960 election were saying that we hadn't spent enough on defense.
Right.
And here you had a former general saying, and he was trying to make this point as clearly as we can,
I think he does,
that
did.
In the long run, our national security is not enhanced by incurring debt.
Bill White, I appreciate this conversation. Thank you very much.
It's been great to be with
you. Yeah, it was great to get you on the show. Bill White, former mayor of Houston, candidate for governor of Texas. His book now is America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse, an argument for returning to a balanced budget. Bill, thanks again.
It's great to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you, folks. That's the first hour of midday today. We'll take our break now for lunch, brought to us by Atwaters. Atwaters supports local radio, local farmers, and local appetites. Located at Belvedere Square, the shops at Kenilworth, Bear Hills, or Main Street, Catonsville, also at Canton Crossing, visit atwaters.biz, B-I-Z, for more information. Please stay tuned for the news and the second hour of our show.